little bit about Megillas Esther. We're about a week away. And Megillas Esther is a very, very subtle, satiric, heavily layered text. And because it's not a straightforward or frontal or unidimensional text, that's why it's the only text we read twice. The Gemara says, source number one, Chayev Adam Likros as a Megillah Bayom, the Shanasab Alayla. The Gemara says in Megillah that unlike any other text in the Torah, it's read twice in succession. So there are texts which are repeated, but because different times call for a similar text. So we read Parsha Zemor when it's Parsha Zemor, and then we read Parsha Zemor in Pesach. But those are two different causalities, two different reasons. We never read a text twice. This is the only time in halachic behavior that we read a Megillah twice in a row. Chayev Adam Likros as a Megillah Bayom, Balayla B'Lashanosa Bayom. The Gemara interprets it or derives it from various psukim. And part of the reason, aside from the psukim, is that it really is such a coded text, and you can't really understand some of the beginning until you read it once and then return home. Now we realize why this story was so crucial, why this decree was so important, why this happened in Perek Gimel, because it will play a role later. I mean, the obvious is Biktan the Teresh conspiracy, because Mordechai has to be inscribed in the Book of Favors, but that's the transparent one. But there's so many subtleties. And in the literary world, it's called hermeneutics. We read a text once, then you reread the text, but now you're more informed, and you're able to advance towards the text with a whole different set of eyes and a whole different set of perspectives. So it's not a simple text to read. It's a delicious text. It's a delicious Megillas Esther. And the truth is, so much of it stems from tandem works or other period works that describe the milieu, and I'll try to tap into some of those. If you tell me, what's the best way I can understand Megillas Esther, I'd say, study Ezra, Nehemiah, and Daniel, and then we'll talk. And you can literally see psukim that are lifted from Ezra and lifted from Daniel and storylines that are very similar. So we'll try to tap into some of that. I think I need a copy also. I think my version is a little different. Thank you.
Sorry, how many people do you need?
Three. Okay, it's fine. It's just for the beginning. Okay, thank you. So what I wanted to study with you tonight is how Chazal started teaching Megillas Esther. Because they realized there was a coded text. So before they taught their students Megillas Esther on Thursday night at Mishmar in Naharda over soup, or in Surah, or in Pompidisa, or in Mechoza, these are the great towns of Bavel, they began their teaching by citing a pasuk from Tanakh that seemingly had absolutely nothing to do with Megillas Esther, totally unrelated, not about Esther, not about Mordechai, not about Amalek, but somehow, if you understand that pasuk, you get a keyhole into something subtle about Megillas Esther. That was their strategy. It's a very popular strategy. It appears in many places in the Medrash where Chazal will quote a pasuk at random and then tie together the psukim in some unforeseen manner. So each member of Chazal had their go-to pasuk with which they began. So let's start, ironically, with the last one on your sources. This is part number Dalet, Shmuel. Shmuel, one of the great third-generation Amoraim, second generation, I should say, the great yeshiva of Naharda. Shmuel, ironically, for tonight's shiur, was actually very close to the Persians. He was part of the diplomatic team that would negotiate on behalf of the Jews with the Persians. So Purim had some very, I imagine, some very, very potent meaning for him. And when Shmuel began teaching Megillas Esther, he started with a pasuk in Bechukosai. The Af Gam Zos, Biyosam Bi'eretz Oyvehem, Lo Miastim, V'lo Gyaltim L'chalosam. Source Dalet, part one. He started with a pasuk in Bechukosai. The nightmares of the Tochacha have been outlined. The Jews are now dispersed into Galus. Hashem promises them, I'll redeem you. I won't disgust you or contempt you or revile you. V'af Gam Zos, Biyosam Bi'eretz Oyvehem, Lo miastim, v'lo gealtim l'chalosam l'afer b'isi'itam. It's actually, it's a very graphic pasuk. This is part Dalet, source one. You may remember this pasuk from Slichot. It's one of the psukim we recite in that lineup of psukim before Shema Kolenu. Zechar alenu b'yisabah, azka shermar, tevitzchadis b'si yitzchak, v'es b'si. This is one of the psukim. Take us back. Don't detest us anymore. Now, Shmuel noted that this pasuk has many clauses. V'af gam zos bi'osam eretz oyvehem, lo me'astim, I won't hate you, lo ge'altim, I won't revile you. somehow he felt that it was referring to different periods. So this is how he read Megillas Esther. Source number two, part Dalet. Shmuel Pasach. Shmuel began his shir with this Pasach in this drasha. Part Dalet, source two. V'yaf gam zos b'yosem meretzor v'hem lo me'astim v'lo g'altem l'chalosam lef rebi si'itam kini Hashem elokeyem lo me'astim be'bavel. I won't disguise to test you in Bavel. Lo g'altem b'madai. I won't revile you at the next stage in Madai. Megillas Esther. L'chalosam b'yavan. And I won't destroy you in Greece. Lef rebi si'itam. And I won't betray our covenant. What is a pasuk in B'chukosai? How is it the key to understanding Megillas Esther? A layer of Megillas Esther. The answer demands that we study Haman a little bit more carefully. This is a man of political savvy, social influence, appears wise, according to Chazal. He's one of the advisors of Ahasuerus. He's not the cartoonish figure that, let's say, Bilam is. Speaking to his donkey, trying almost desperately to outwit Hashem. Bilam's a cartoon figure. Pyro's a pathetic figure, having his heart toyed with and exploited by the Rabboni Shel Olam. Haman is a rising star. And this isn't capricious, this is meritorious. He's a person that deserves to be promoted. What was his great mistake? He didn't realize the Jewish people had defeated any and every foe that had risen up to challenge them and to challenge their place in history. Well, of course, Haman wasn't operating in a vacuum, because Haman was Esav's grandson. But the first grandson of Esav to take this challenge was none other than Amalek. Amalek was the son of Eliphaz, who was the son of Esav. And he was tasked by his grandfather with trying to reverse the selection of Yaakov at the expense of Esav, that had so infuriated Esav. That was Amalek's task. And in fact, it wasn't just tasked to him by his father Eliphaz, it was incited by his mother. Amalek's mother was a woman named Timnah, who was Eliphaz's Pilegesh. Not his wife, his Pilegesh, but she bore to him Amalek. It's not clear whether she bore Amalek or was just a concubine on hand to poison Amalek's mind. And part of her agitation was because she was a princess of the original Canaanite tribes, of the Chiti tribes. Her brother was Lotan, who was one of the generals, Achot Lotan Timnah. And she was so attracted by this budding and burgeoning movement of Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov. She decides she wants to join, so she defects from her palace, and she takes league with Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, who ultimately spurn her, because she's a foreign seed. So she's absolutely determined to be part of this family, so she says, you know what? I'd rather be a concubine in the house of the understudy than to be a princess in my own palace. So she joins Esav's family as a Pilegesh, just to get her foot in the door. But at some point she turns, and at some point all this desire turns into hatred. And that happens often in life. Unrequited desire turns into hatred. So she starts hating Yaakov. And she incites her son, Amalek, to lead that process in history. And Amalek rears its head precisely at the moments when Jews are about to reach their destiny. They are almost sleeper cells. They don't just emerge incidentally or serendipitously. They always emerge when Jewish history is about to leap forward. So this Shabbos we'll read Parsha Zachar. Ashekarcha baderech. Well, there's a lot of ballyhooing about that word ashekarcha, but why the derech? So derech is a double entendre. It highlights the fact Jews were vulnerable, weak, fragile, exposed, newly developed. But it's also forward-thinking. They were on their way to Israel. And you think that Israel is 40 years away, but that isn't the way it was meant to be. Israel is meant to be 3 months away. I think I only met one girl. From Westchester, right?
Yeah.
You were not meant to live in Westchester.
Yeah.
And I was not meant to live in Brooklyn. And none of the places you've inhabited were ever meant to exist. Because history was meant to close. 24, 48 years into history, it was meant to close. The Jews were meant to march into Israel around summertime, defeat the local kingdoms, usher in utopia, the age of God, the age of human welfare, and history ends. Everything since then has been a long detour. It's all a mirage. It's all an illusion. You have to live in an illusion. That's the power of a Jew, to live a schizophrenic life, to embrace the illusion and to adapt it and to advance it, but not to ever be satisfied with it. This is real. The room we're sitting in is ground zero of Jewish history and of human history. So when the Jews are about to march onto Israel, Shekarcha Baderech, the sirens start going off in Amalek's head. It's not Amalek per se, but Amalek's descendants. And father had told child, and mother had told child, generation after generation, when Yaakov rises, you must intervene. Right now, Yaakov is subservient, is enslaved, is being persecuted. It's fine. But when Yaakov rises, you better awaken. Ashakarcha baderach. And the truth is, we don't really defeat Amalek. We just reach some uneasy armistice. Vayachlo Yoshua. We defeat them, but they're not in any way completely, completely triumphed over or vanquished. And then there's another round. And then the next round takes place in Sefer Shmuel, when the Jews are not just living in Israel, but they're about to take a quantum leap forward and achieve monarchy. So now we have a king. And it resonates. Because Jewish monarchy means the Jewish capital will be founded in Yerushalayim at some point. And then maybe Mashiach is now available and that selection will materialize and be implemented. So Agag goes to battle. Because he's heard the stories from his grandparents and his great-great-grandparents. When the Jews rise, you stand tall. My Rebbe, Rav Amital, would always tell us the following story. There was someone in the shtetl whose job it was to wake up all the Jews during the entire month of Elul and make sure they came for slichas. And every day he'd go banging on the doors, get up, wake up. Anyone speak Yiddish? No Yiddish speakers? So they used to wake people up. Stay up, stay off, lavoda sabari. Get up, go daven, stay off means get up. Finally, Erev Rosh Hashanah time comes and he's exhausted. He's been up all month. So during slichos and Erev Rosh Hashanah, he's schluffing. He's nodding away. So they start taking paper balls and they start rolling them up into little balls and they start tossing it in his general direction. I need this, but I don't need that. Right? Start tossing it at Mendel. Mendel, wake up, wake up. He says, what's your name? Rick. I'm exhausted. What do you want from me? I say, Mendel, you kept us up all Chodesh Elul. You think we're going to let you sleep now? Am Yisrael kept the entire world awake for thousands of years. We challenged them to higher moral ground. We challenged them to a monotheism they weren't yet ready to imagine, and then they slowly came around to. Jews are the conscience of the world. We're the Mamlachas Kohanim V'Goy Kadosh. We stand for family. We stand for social justice. We stand for studying the will of God. We stand for willing to die for that love. That's a challenge. The entire, people don't like a challenge. People don't like the alarm clock. So now we just want to go to sleep in Israel. You know what the nations of the world are telling us? Mendeleev. You kept us awake for thousands of years. You think we're going to let you sleep now in Israel? Just go to sleep in your homeland in tranquility? So they're throwing things at us. They're throwing their bombs and their missiles because they don't want us to go to sleep. We don't let them sleep for thousands of years. And now it's Haman's turn. But Haman has a twist. And it's a brilliant twist. And believe me, you and I probably would have gone for that twist. And probably the Jews were also pretty convinced by Haman's assertion, because it was very bold, but it seemed to ring true. You were the chosen people, but you forfeited that status. Just look. You're no longer living in Israel. You no longer have the Beis HaMikdash. You've been routed. You've been massacred. You've been replanted into Babylonia, into Persia. Listen carefully to what I'm about to say. Historically, not theologically, historically, Haman was the first Christian. Theologically, he's Zoroastrian. But historically, this becomes Christianity's and Islam's claim. We were chosen, but we sinned, and we fell from grace. That was his assertion. That was his bold challenge. I can't defeat the chosen people. My grandparents failed. They flunked. But it's a new era. And God has disgusted and repelled and contempted his people, sending them into Persia, burning his temple, burning the Beis HaMikdash. It's a really incredible assertion. I think the Jews weren't certain about their response to that. What does Haman tell Achashverosh? Yeshno am echad mifuzar u'mifarad bein amim. They're now bein amim. They're no longer viam, hein am levadad yishko. They're just bein amim. They're just a nation. They can be defeated like all nations. That was the hidden message of Purim. We have a bris. And a bris, can I close the door? Is that all right? And a bris outlasts infidelity. But a bris is a covenant, not based on meeting ground, emotional synchronicity, timing. Mirtz Hashem, a couple years. Soon, some sooner, some later, you'll all find that bris. It's called marriage. Marriage isn't all love and romance and starry-eyed. It's commitment. Let's build. Let's raise a family. Let's build a home. Let's share resources. Hopefully there's a lot of love. But the moment said it's not love. It's just commitment. And the moment you're committed and you're committed to that covenant, even when you're not necessarily in love with your spouse, and that's in no way saying you have less romance than the other person. It's just the human emotional cycle oscillates so wildly, it's hard to imagine you're always in the same synchronicity. Two people's emotional state are always overlapping. It never happens in a constant state. And Lepor Hashem proved that he loves us and he's committed to us even when we don't deserve it, because we didn't really deserve it. That's the saga of Purim that Shmuel was trying to touch, was trying to identify. So he quoted the pasuk, Af gam zos. You could be far away from Israel. You could be saddled in your enemy's country. Lo me'astim. Lo ge'altim. L'chalosam l'hafer b'risi itam. Have a bris. That bris I'll never betray. I'll never forfeit. That's Purim's historical message. That's why Purim has so many undertones of Shavuos. You take a look at, I don't know where my pages are anymore, but should have them somewhere. You take a look at source number Dalid, part 3. The end of Parak Tet describes the Jews agreeing to Esther's requests for the mitzvot and the customs of the day. Kimu v'kiblu ha'yehudim alayim ve'al zaram. The Jewish people accepted Esther's request. That's a very, very poetic acceptance. Kimu v'kiblu. The Gemara in Shabbos infers that the pasuk is not describing merely embracing Esther's request. Darash Baal Peh, but that's a second layer of Darasha, just Torah. Torah. It's a Medrash, but the first layer, the Gemara says in Shabbos, that in Har Sinai, much of Har Sinai was impositional, was unilateral, was Hashem compelling the Jews, hoisting the mountain, forcing them. Religion can't be based totally on compulsion. Samar Vachar Bar Yaakov, source 4, line 4. Amar Rava, let's first quote Rava, second to last line, source 4. Afal Pikein, even though it was imposed upon them at Har Sinai, Hadar Kiblu Bime Achashverosh. They freely accepted it during the days of Achashverosh. Dechsev, Kimu Vikiblu HaYehudim. Kimu Mashikvar Kiblu. At Har Sinai, they were Makabel, they just receptors. Hashem delivers. In Persia, in Paras, in Shushan, they were active mekayimah. They were active participants. Kimu v'kiblu. There's a stunning medrash that you've heard before, but not in this form. Where have you heard the following medrash? Midrash says that the trees of Shushan were vying for Haman to be hung on them. And the cedar tree came and said, I'm the tallest, maybe Haman should be hung on me. Exactly. And the olive tree said, I have the nicest fruit. And the mahogany tree said, I have the nicest wood. And then some lowly, unassuming, unattractive tree was awarded. It's exactly the Har Sinai Midrash. Because this is Har Sinai chapter 2. And the hanging of Haman parallels the delivery of Torah. Because it reinforces that message. Lo me'astim, lo ge'altim l'chalasam, l'hafer b'risi'itam. That's why Shmuel began his teaching with this pasuk. Because he was trying to highlight that aspect. Let's see how many we can get to. Hope we'll get to at least two, maybe three. Definitely not four. Still have to prepare my shiur for tomorrow. A couple of them. Okay. Reb Berechia, even more interesting pasuk. So let's go back to Reb Berechia, the beginning, part number one. Okay. Reb Berechia quoted a pasuk in Yeshaya, Mem Aleph. I think on your versions I didn't quote the pasuk. Is the pasuk there? No. But it's in the first medrash. Mi pa'al v'yasa, korea deros mirosh, HaKadosh Baruch Hu created this world. He beckons the generations. So the connotation of this pasuk in Yeshaya is that Hashem foresees the evolution of different generations. It's an anthropological pasuk. And different generations introduce different phenomena to mankind, to the human race. So for example, source number Aleph, part 1, line 2, Mitchilas b'riyasa shel olam hiskin HaKadosh Baruch Hu l'chol echad v'yechad masheroi lo. Adam rosh layotzrim. Aleph part 1. Adam is the first creature. That makes sense. Kayan rosh layotzrim. That's when murder enters the human vernacular. Etc., etc., etc. There's a roster of the evolution of human generations and what was introduced into human phenomena at each generation. It's a fascinating medrash. I accepted it for our purposes. What was introduced during Megillas Esther? Achashverosh Rosh Lakonim. Haman Rosh Lamochrim. The opposite. Achashverosh Rosh Lamochrim. Achashverosh was the first seller. Haman was the first buyer. And we know what this is referring to. Some seemingly secondary, almost oblique pasuk. Haman offers 10,000 shekels. Achashverosh says no problem. Then he gives back to, returns it to Haman. Why is that such a dramatic moment? Why does it announce Achashverosh as the Rosh Hamochrim and Haman as the Rosh Hamochrim and Haman as the Rosh Hakonim? Seems almost irrelevant, almost idiosyncratic. Why is that so important? They're murderers. They're genocidal maniacs. At least Haman was. We care about the money.
Doesn't that mean it wasn't ideological? Like it was
pragmatic? Yeah. Yeah, but you have to contextualize that. Let's try to contextualize that. It's really not a question on the Medrash. It's a question on the Pasuk. Why is that data bit important enough to be recorded? Who cares? Miguel Sessa doesn't record what Haman was wearing that day, despite your contrary assumption that Hamantashen come from his three-cornered hat, which he never wore. Anyone know where Hamantashen really come from? Right, but why Purim?
Hiding inside.
Close. Well, I don't really have time to describe this, but the real hero of Purim lived about 70 years before Purim. And he makes cameo appearances in Megillas Esther, and all these supporting actors are attributed to him. Who's the real hero?
Daniel,
very good. Because Daniel is exiled from Israel 18 years before the mass exile. And he's an up-and-coming celeb. He's bright. He's a leader. And Nebuchadnezzar is a master strategist. And he thinks if he can take the up-and-coming Jewish leadership and transplant them into Babel 18 years ahead of the mass exodus, he can train them to be the vanguard, the transition team, to help the Jews transition into Babylonian culture. So he'll take the rising stars, the A-list, 30 under 30. He'll replace them into a Babylonian fortress. He'll acculturate them to Babel, and then they'll help the rest of the population transition. And that's how Sefer Daniel begins. And he feeds them magnificent palatial food, which is probably kosher. But Daniel says, I'm not eating. Pat bag hamelech, because I know what's up. I know that sometimes it's not just whether the food is kosher, but what lasting effect the food is meant to convey. Food is not just food. He refuses to eat. He's starving, so he asks the guards to smuggle in some beans and lentils and seeds for him. High in protein, easy to conceal. So they smuggle in these seeds, and he survives. And because of his stand, the Jews maintain their identity, and they're able to return 70 years later, in part thrusted by the miracle of Purim, which occurs right as they're returning to Eretz Israel. So that's why Chazal is trying to work Daniel into all. Hasach, he's probably Daniel. Charvona, he's probably Daniel. Whether they meant it or not, they meant that the Jewish resurgence was introduced by Daniel. So everything that's happening has the influence of Daniel. And because of those seeds, we eat Hamantashen, because the original Hamantashen were poppy seeds. That's the authentic tradition. That's where it starts. The Ramban, Shulchan Aruch, quotes that tradition. To eat Hamantashen because of Daniel. Anyway, can I just ask one of the girls to smuggle in a cup of water for me? Thanks. Winter cold. Thank you. Anyway, getting back to Shushan. Shushan is a fascinating, fascinating culture. Because on the surface, it presents as a culture that's very dynamic, meritocracy-based, merit-based, flexible, and it shuns or rejects the hierarchies that had existed in so many ancient cultures. And you see this on many fronts. First of all, you see this by the swift changes in the political landscape that are really unprecedented. We're used to them in quick changing democracies. But in classic monarchies, monarchs aren't replaced that easily. And the first monarch, thank you, what's your name?
Nina.
Nina. The first monarch, thank you, to demonstrate that Shushan isn't influenced by hierarchies or trapped by hierarchies is Ahasuerus. Ahasuerus doesn't have royal blood. Chazal interpret his name Ahasuerus, source 4, Amar Rav Shemalach Me'atzmo. Somehow the word Ahasuerus is interpreted to self-coronation. Ahasuerus was a stable hand to Belshazzar, the successor to Nebuchadnezzar. And on that fateful night when Belshazzar, the last Babylonian emperor, was ransacked, as described in Sefer Daniel with the writing on the wall, while he's partying because he thinks the 7 years have expired and now the Jews will never be returned, so he takes the Klei HaMikdash and he starts celebrating and boozing up with the Klei HaMikdash, his kingdom is ransacked that night. The Empire of Babel falls. Ahasuerus escapes. He's a stable hand. He marries royalty, Vashti. He's an opportunist. And then he ascends the Persian Median throne. So he's not royal, which is very, very atypical. And the political swings in Megillas Esther demonstrate very similar upward mobility and political flexibility rather than rigidity. Who is he? He's not even a Persian. Hagagi. He's a foreigner. How many years did it take the United States to nominate an African-American or a woman? Right away, 2-3 years into his empire, you got an Hagagi sending the throne or second in command. Vashti is replaced by Esther. And Mordechai worms his way into the royal throne, the royal court. Source number 5, by Amimahim, Mordechai Yoshev Bishar Melech. Who invited him? We know who invited him, Esther, but you don't just walk in. I always thought that that may have been the reason that Bigtan and Teresh were infuriated. Because maybe they were old schoolers, and they didn't like this new political echelon. They were old school, and you have to earn it, and you have to be part of the landed aristocracy, and you can't just walk in and elect yourself because of the juxtaposition. Mordechai Yoshev Bishar Melech, Katsaf, Bigtan Vaterish. Source number five. Typical way to read it is because he was there, he heard their conspiracy, he was able to uncover their plot. But it was thought that their conspiracy, their anger, may have been based on Mordechai's free entry into a world that they thought was royal and barred to commoners. So you've got a really politically flexible system that isn't trapped in the classic hierarchies of antiquity. But it's not just politically flexible. It's also culturally pluralistic. 127 empires. And intriguingly enough, there's absolutely no effort whatsoever to homogenize people's culture or ethnicity, rather to sustain it. So everyone shows up at the meal. Source number six, second to last line, third to last line, Vashkos beklei zahav, some wanted to drink out of gold goblets, because that was their custom, v'kelim mikelim shonim, but there were many other options on the menu, hashtiach hadas, einones, no one was forced to drink. This sounds refreshing to girls coming from North America, where there's been a tendency to try to go dry because of the dangers of alcoholism. But in ancient circles, there was a protocol to attending a royal meal. You had to drink a certain amount and eat in a certain way. You didn't just sit back and eat when you want and how you want. It was step by step. This is, the king is here, the course is served, you eat this. This is a very democratic meal. Lasos kirtzon ish vaish. Kichen yisad ha-melech. Al kol rav beiso. Lasos kirtzon ish vaish. There were various gemaras I didn't quote, but if you turn the page, I don't know if you take turn the page. Source number 10. Chatzar, Ginas Bisan HaMelech. Some people sat in the outer courtyard. Some people sat in the house, the Bitan, right? Some people sat in the veranda, the garden. Any English girls? You have an English accent, right? So you have a garden in your home, a nice English garden?
I do.
Right, like sitting out in the afternoon?
Not
you would have found the garden the one day.
Yeah.
Very pluralistic. Everyone's invited. L'chalam anim tzim b'shushan, 180 days. You don't have to succumb or submit to any one cultural ethic or ethos. And even the moments in the storyline, which are very, very legislative and legal, in which Achashverosh's authority is brought to bear, those decrees, and there are plenty of decrees, and the decrees are part of the literary tropes that hold the Megillah together. Good decrees, bad decrees, silly decrees. But when he decrees, and I just quoted for you the first decree, take a look at source number 7, Vayishlach Sfarim al kol medinot ha-melech ha-chashverosh al medina, 127, multi-regional. Medina u-medina kichtava. Each community, each empire, each province got the decree in its font. Am va'am kilashono, interpreted. No one was forced to speak English. No one was forced to abdicate their mother tongue. Am va'am kilashono. This is a stunning experiment in political democracy, cultural pluralism, multi-regional tolerance. It's a real breath of fresh air. Until you dig a little deeper. Because what happens in a society in which cultural norms, values that tend to form the coalescence of populations and communities, those values no longer exist. Because it's a pluralistic society in which all values are valid. Because people just come from so many different sectors and provinces that no one value can collect people's imagination and form communal, family, imaginative coalescence. There's one value that will always rise to the top. And that's the great equalizer, the universal value. That's called money. Because money speaks different languages. And Shushan is obsessed with money. And not just money, but the abuse of money. 180 days. 180 days. Hedonistic eating, bestial regurgitation, But it's not just the pointlessness of it all. It's that it's performed in public display, in an exhibitionist, shameless fashion. People lying on alabaster beds and marble floors, vomiting in their own naked stew and eating more for people to watch and gawk at. No shame. Because they just want to display their wealth. Because there's no other value that will capture people's attention, because your cultural codes are different from mine, so your codes don't in any way impress me. But wealth is universal. And if I could display my wealth, then people will listen, because it speaks every language. And the party is one big exhibition of wealth, affluence, in an ostentatious, opulent, exhibitionist, shameless fashion. Gold, silver, cups, alabaster beds, risa bav, vashesh, vadaris, sacharis. I remember visiting England, right when I was your age, a long time ago, 370 years ago. And I went to Buckingham Palace, and I saw in a display case, it was a huge salt shaker. But it was humongous. It was the size of that chalent pot. Now, I like salt, but I can't imagine eating that much salt. So I asked the tour guide, who had such an appetite for salt? So I remember him chuckling and says, you didn't eat the salt. Salt in Europe in a medieval period was very expensive. You would sit at your table and place the largest goblet of salt you could find just to demonstrate how wealthy you were. That was just a status symbol. Hence the phrase, he's not or she's not worth his salt. It's a fake. It's a forfeit. It's a forgery. There's a lot of salt, but he's not worth it. Sometimes we have our own status symbols. As people sometimes flash cars, cell phones, clothing. A lot of girls in this room will be wealthy one day. May happen. We're facing uncharted territory because we don't really have a masara how to deal with wealth. We really weren't wealthy for much of our 2,000 years in Gullus. We don't have sfarim talking about what to do with excess wealth personally or collectively. We just don't have it. Maybe in the Spanish era. I think part of the major challenge that our community faces, under the radar, you'll build nice homes. You're building homes in a modest, understated fashion, in a way that's gawkish and tawdry and exhibitionist and flaunting wealth. You know, dress. This is really not my place to speak about it, because I just, obviously men don't get it. It's hard for men to totally get it, but as far as I can get it, from my vantage point, tznius is not about clothing, and it's not something for girls or women. Tznius is the recognition that Kodesh Baruch Hu's in the room. When you recognize your Ribono Shel Olam is in the room, you take that into account one way or another. Someone in the room, there's some essence in the room, and I'm not going to grandstand, promote myself, project my own personality. There's something larger than me in the room. That's how I would define tznius, the recognition of Hashem's presence. Now, there are many, many manifestations of tznius, and for women, there's one manifestation. For men, there are other manifestations, and for women, clothing. But it's a recognition. You stand in front of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And when you flaunt your own wealth and your own earning potential, it's as flimsy and as transient as easy comes, easy go. It's lacking tznius. You just don't have any tznius. Someone told me, I was in America 2 weeks ago, they tell me for Super Bowl Sunday, any girls here from the Five Towns? No, so there was a restaurant that was selling a $1,000 pastrami sandwich with flakes of gold mixed into the sandwich. There was clearly an opportunity. Some people asked me, like, what I thought, just says not sneak stick. So I would think of people to flaunt their wealth while they're eating. There's that combination of displaying their wealth. I can afford it. It's not like it tasted. Its taste wasn't worth $1,000. It was the experience of flaunting how wealthy you were. But also while you're eating, which is another moment you have to display tznius. Not to be eating in a way that attracts attention or celebrates yourself. So that's what's happening in Shusha. And it's an immoral party. 180 days of indolence. Who's footing the bill? For 180 days of frolicking and drunkenness and people in the provinces are being taxed through the nose. Taxed through the nose. Shmuel says, source number 9, Revchanina Amar, why is he called part Aleph, source number 9, why is he called Achashverosh? Shakol Nasin Russian Biyamav, everyone became poor. But girls, it wasn't just that he taxed people. What you had in Shushan was you had a funneling and a concentration of wealth that had been occurring for hundreds of years. There are periods in history in which wealth aggregates rather than being dispersed. And you had witnessed the aggregation of wealth in a funneling fashion for several centuries. It started with, of course, Shlomo, gathering the wealth, centering around the Beis HaMikdash. But there was a lot of dominant empires that quickly entered the field and grabbed the wealth from the previous empire. So Sancheirev became this huge, indomitable force, capturing the entire Mediterranean crescent in the north of Israel and marching on Yerushalayim and only falling on Erev Pesach, on Pesach. And he acquires all the wealth. And then Nebuchadnezzar and Babel defeat Sancheirev. And they take the wealth. The Empire of Sumadai defeats Babel. And part of it is the wealth of the Mikdash. It has been added to this funnel effect. So you got a concentration of wealth and an uneven distribution of that wealth. It's always true in history that as human beings aggregate wealth, it's harder to try to find systems to disperse it equitably. We're living through such an era. Right? The last time we lived through such an era was the turn of the 20th century. After the Industrial Revolution, transportation, steam engines, railroads, the Gilded Age. So there are a couple of robber barons or industrialists who control the wealth. And some of that disproportion led to the frictions that caused so much infighting and warring, part of it. Can't say that the two wars were primarily economic, but they were fueled by economic unrest. We're now living through a similar period in which in major Western cultures, such as America and in Israel, the income gap between the top 1% and the rest of the 99% is starting to stretch. It's an unhealthy society. So you see this on display in Shushan. People are frolicking for 180 days while those in the provinces are being taxed with their nose, starving to death. Hakol Nasin Russian Biyama. That's why Achashverosh is called Rosh Lamochrim and Haman Rosh Lakonim. Because it's symbolic. It's iconic. The role money plays in Shushan. Everything in Shushan has a price. Even genocide. Even genocide has a price. If you just pay enough money, you can afford to kill an entire people. And no one will bat an eyelash. Because that's what it's come to in Shushan. Because there is no value, cultural. There's only one value that rises to the top, and it's money and wealth. And us, and that begins the slide into exploitationism, exhibitionism. Many of you may have read that the pastor, Billy Graham, passed away a day or two ago. So he was a pastor to many presidents, and very religious Catholic. He was Catholic, Christian. Fidelity, he once said, and I'm only paraphrasing, that if a person is able to work out a balanced approach to money, that becomes, and basically he's able to build a balanced approach to the world. That's almost as if the test case for the ability to balance your life and deal with your life with equanimity and poise. You're able to deal with not being too frugal, being generous, not hoarding your money, earning responsibly. That whole balancing act is a barometer for success in balancing all the other areas of your life. I don't do justice to the way he said it. So that's why when Reb Berechia wanted to introduce Megillas Esther and wanted to touch upon this moral decay, he called Achashverosh Rosh Lamochrim and Haman Rosh Lakonim, because in Shushan it had become a society that idolized and deified money, the display of money, the abuse of money, the wealth and power that money provided. And sadly enough, I'll only speak about this very briefly because it may not be tsnius for me to say it in even more graphic terms. But once you slide into that realm of exhibitionism around wealth, the next stop on the exhibitionist train is pornography. And this Megillas Esther is one cesspool of pornography. It's absolutely despicable. To march Vashti out, Laharos Amimis Yafiyah, to show everyone, because you're drunk with your friends, and you're sitting in a bar, as the Gemara says, comparing Median women to Persian women. Let's see which are nicer. The complete and total objectification of the human body. Because why not? If we're looking at each other's wealth, why not look at each other's bodies? Right? Once we've trained our eyes to look at the other and not see values or essence, but just to see money, well, what's the difference looking at their wallet or looking at their body? One and the same. Be'erev hivav, avaku hishava. A year-long pornography contest to see who will be the queen. What do you think they were doing at night? A chavrusa? It's despicable. It was frontal pornography, frontal molestation of women in the worst possible fashion. That's the next step. It's obvious. And Esther is the corrective. Finally, when Esther enters the room, figuratively, there's a correction. Esther, source number Aleph, part 12, Vayhi Bayom HaShlishi, Vatil Bash Esther Malchus. See that inversion? She wears not clothing, but dignity. Royalty. Not about the clothes. It's about the dignity that you exude. One of my favorite underappreciated presidents was Gerald Ford. Gerald Ford replaced Richard Nixon after impeachment. And he was a clumsy, clumsy, clownish figure. He would fall off of Air Force One stairs rolling down into the tarmac. He would come down the West Wing circular staircase and trip over his feet. Saturday Night Live had a field day. But he was very homespun. He always quoted his father, Mr. Avicha. He was bald. He was once meant to speak in Boca Raton, Florida. Any girls in Florida? Boca Raton stuff. He got caught in a monsoon before the speech. And he walked into the room with 10,000 people looking more frazzled than he normally appeared, which was saying something. Whatever little hair he had was standing on end and the suit was crumpled. So he quotes his father. He says, "My father always told me that dignity is not of the cloth nor of the wallet. It's of the spirit. Don't think you're more dignified by the clothing you wear, whether they're nicer or less, or by the money you own, whether it's more or less. I've seen many, many wealthy people who would not know dignity if it slapped them in the face. Many people with fancy threads don't know the first thing about dignity. I've seen many commoners who walk with dignity." And Esther walks into the room, and finally, Valtilbash is not about what her body appears as. It's about who she is. For the first time, and the truth is the only time in Tanakh this phrase appears. Good trick question for your brother, who thinks he's such a big Talmud Chacham. Ask him this question. Vayev HaMelech is Esther. Source 13, Mikol HaNashim. Vatisa Chein V'Chesed. The only time in Tanakh. Chein V'Chesed. The two appear in tandem. If you remember, when Esther was appointed queen, a phrase in a pasuk in the end of Perek Beis that I didn't write for you, Hanacha Lamedinos Asa. Esther brought some tax relief to the provinces. Ahasuerus was so happy at Esther's selection that he eases the tax burden. So Esther's nomination is accompanied by a tax release. Kinder tax laws. And of course, ultimately, for Esther, money and the mitzvah that she introduces to the Purim experience is not meant to be spent on egocentric, self-serving interests, but to be shared with less fortunate. So it's only obvious that Esther, Chayamim, source 15, Asher nachu b'hem hayudim e'ovehem, v'chodesh shenepachna miyagon l'simcha, l'asos osam yimei mishte v'simcha, it's obvious that for her, she's not going to spend it on herself. I mean, do you ever think why there's a need to be mitakin in mitzvah on Purim of tzedakah? Every day you're chayv in tzedakah. You're chayiv in staka every day of your life. If a Jew comes and approaches you and asks for a handout, you don't have the right to say no. If you do, you are mevatel a mitzvah's essay in the Torah. If you have money on you. You don't have to give that person your entire wallet. You didn't just give whatever you get. And if the person can't change the $20 bill, that means you don't have money or you have a credit card. But assuming you've got that quarter in your pocket or that dollar bill that you don't need, and a Jew asks for it, there's a mitzvah in the Torah. You can't say no. People aren't aware of this halacha. It's like not eating matzah. I wouldn't not eat matzah. I'm just not keeping matzah this year. Can't not keep tzedakah. So there's no reason to be mitakin, an overlapping, redundant mitzvah. But Esther wants to underscore the corrective, palliative effect she had, restoring some semblance of dignity and decency. This rampant culture. So off to the races with ostentationism and exhibitionism and reality shows and looking at each other's bodies and plastic surgeries and objectifying people and very dangerous world we live in. Society is worshipped at the altar of multiculturalism in a way that's blinded it to some of the dangers of multiculturalism. Pluralism, openness, accepting the other, very important values, especially to correct some of the imbalances. So many hundreds of years of persecution and discrimination and racism. But there are heavy prices we pay. And very, very stiff dangers. And Trump is just the beginning of it. Trump is just the reaction to it. Just uncovers the monster. But there are deep dangers that multiculturalism poses for moral behavior, not even Jewish identity, just moral behavior. And you're seeing some of that emerge under the cloak of multiculturalism in Shushan. It's the power of gold and greed that drives Shushan. Because all other values have been eliminated because everyone's accepted on their own. So there's no value system or hierarchy that sets identity. Or I'm successful if I belong to a certain caste or group or guild or level. Society's been leveled. So the only altitude that people can achieve is through money. And it becomes flaunting their money and displaying their wealth or their physical appearance. And that's what Berechi was trying to describe when he tabled Achashverosh as Rosh Lamochrim and Haman as Rosh Lakoni. Yes?
So based on that, the concept of like Matzmat Lev Yonim and all that on Purim makes sense, but the concept of Mishteh doesn't make so much sense if the whole...
That would be an entirely different year. We're not even going to make it through half of this year. But that's the question of what role parties play. Because Esther also makes parties. Her parties are a little different. They're object-oriented. They're not indulgent. That's why she delays the parties. But that'll have to be some other time. There are 10 parties, Miguel's Esther. Count them. Yes? What's your name?
Tamar. Just going back to what you said kind of at the beginning, that Amelie always comes at a point when Amishal's about to do something great. How does that fit with the idea of if you think that the second Beit HaMikdash was already built during the time of Megillah Esther?
It wasn't built. It was the foundations were laid. And what you're saying is correct, that it may have also been Haman interceding. See, that's also a different shear. If you look at Ezra Perek Dalet, the attempts to resettle the land of Israel, which had been partially successful, have been sanctioned by Koresh, in the beginning of Ezra, screeched to a halt because the locals are opposed to Jewish return. Shocker, right? And there are people who agitate against the Jewish return, and they write letters of sitna. Look at Perek Dalet of Ezra, but have an English or Hebrew translation because it's written in Aramaic. They write letters of sitna back to Koresh, urging him, by the way, just to show you the overlap between Daniel, or in this case Ezra, and Achashverosh, or Esther, if you allow the Jews to get away with this, they're conspiring against you, they're not going to pay proper taxes, this will domino throughout your entire empire, Koresh. And then everyone will disobey your rules. That's the echo of the end of Perek Aleph. If you allow Vashti to rebel against your authority, all women will rebel against. There's so many overlaps. It's almost like a satire. It's laughing at Achashverosh and laughing at Haman by overlapping all the scenarios of contemporary works. Anyway, Tamar, what's interesting is that the people leading these letter writings back to Koresh, one of the groups is called Bnei Itrachashta. Chazal say, get ready, they were the 10 children of Haman. Now, what's fascinating about that is twofold. First of all, that initially they weren't anti-Jews, they were anti-Israel. We don't dislike Jews, they just can't settle Israel. And a few years later, it turns out they're homicidal, genocidal, let's kill Jews. Let's remember that there are those in the Hamans who still live in Haman's home territory, Iran, who may parade or project themselves, we're not anti-Jews, we're anti-Israel. Part of the drama was these same people who were writing anti-Israel, anti-settlers, anti-Gush Etzion letters then became genocidal letters. That's why the letters play such an important role in Megillas Esther. That also explains why they were hung. Because they seem to be the innocent victims of Megillas Esther. Haman has to be hung. But what does children do? They were playing soccer. 10 people have a soccer team. Zeresh was the goalie. I mean, they have a problem. Why? Now, we know they have to be killed because they're a Amalek, but did they deserve to be killed? So they're complicit in the whole process by connecting Ezra to Megillas Esther. And it reminds us of how much this was a struggle to overcome. It's almost as if, well, that's a whole difference here as well, the penalty and the peril facing the Jews was because they weren't active enough in assisting the return to Israel. They were too indulgent in the affairs of Shushan and the parties of Shushan. But it's certainly there's some truth that Haman is capitalizing upon that rebuffing of Jewish resettling, possibly to land the final blow. So we have to end now, halfway through. But I want you to appreciate how deep the Sefer is. I'll just give you two hints and let you try to fill in the blanks on your own. First of all, if any of you want, so I've done 8 of these shiurim on YU Torah, so you can do a triple search. My name is Moshe Tarragon. Do a sub-search on Purim. Do a sub-sub-search on the word preambles. I call them Chazal's preambles to Esther. Don't worry. Each of these is about 15 minutes long. It's only when I'm tired that I tend to be verbose. When I'm actually recording something, I can speak very quickly. So about 15 minutes. Number two, Rav talked about a pasuk in the second Tochacha, just to give you a little hint of what's happening, which describes two different types of fear that human beings undergo. Long-term fear or long-term dread, and short-term panic. And somehow, even though normally in our lives and experiences the two don't overlap, we either dread things that will happen in 20 years, or we're immediately shocked by the monster effect. In Persia and in Shushan, both occurred. And why is that important? And what was Rav trying to convey? And the most intriguing part of tonight's year is when part number Gimel, when Reish Lakish, he quoted a pasuk from Daniel, in which the four empires are likened to four different animals. And the second animal in the dream is a bear. And the bear represents Parasu Madai. And Reish Lakish said, you know why a bear represents Parasu Madai? Because a bear has four qualities. How it eats, its physical anatomy, it's very hairy, and it's constantly restless. The last three lines of Source Gimel Part 2. And somehow each of these qualities of a bear captures metaphorically, it's not like the Persians had hair. Metaphorically, hair represents something, awkward anatomy represents something, foraging represents something. What about Madai and Paras made them resemble bears? What was the moral challenges of facing the bears? So we don't really have enough time for any of this, but you'll just have to wait. Purim Sameach, girls. Purim Sameach. Enjoy your Purim. Enjoy your Purim. Okay, I'm going to make a quick goodbye. A lot happening tonight still. So we have to leave quickly. Sure.
Why
why specifically Haman the Mocher? Ahasuerus the Mocher and Haman the
Oh, because Ahasuerus was selling the Jews down the river. So Haman offered the money. Together, they're
selling. Was Haman the one selling and Ahasuerus the one potentially buying, and then
no.
It ended up being.
Oh, there's just buying. Yeah, but he's buying people. He's buying people. Haman was buying people.
Ahasuerus
was selling people.
And Masechta Megillah talks about how, like...
Ahasuerus has the dominion, so he's selling them to Haman. I will give you the Jewish people
right,
for your money.
Originally, when we talk about the law, just like, who's the one who does it all? Haman is the one who says, I'm going to sell you this. Like, I'm going to give you money
right.
for those Jews. So he's selling them.
Right, but they're each Rosh.
Yeah, so
he's selling people. You're objectifying people, so Ahasuerus is selling and Haman is buying. But forget who's initiating. The role they're playing surrounds the people, not the money. So Ahasuerus is selling people and Haman is buying people. Verstehts? That means you understand. Baruch atah Adonai Eloheinu melech haolam bein nefeshah sabas lechasen ala kol ma shebasen lechitz bein nefesh kochai baruch ha'olamin.
Thank you.
You're welcome.